All right, today is 18 July 2014. I am Major Randolph Scott Harrison, and I am telephonically interviewing retired Captain Brackage. He was the third program director of the IPAP. He was also the Navy representative on the initial committee for the establishment of the IPAP. We are in Johns Creek, Georgia, at the PA History Society. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Scott. Thank you for that introduction. I might just clarify one thing. I was a Navy captain, which does make some difference.
Yes, sir.
And appreciate this opportunity to be of some assistance, hopefully, to you in writing some of the history.
Absolutely, sir. This morning, I'd like to start off with, if you could just tell us, sir, briefly about your formative years and where you were born and things like that, sir.
I was born in northwest Oklahoma, and I grew up on the farm with intentions along the way of going to medical school, and had a number of events happen that made that impossible at that point. And then the draft came along for the Vietnam, and the Army decided that they wanted me, and I didn't really want to go to the Army, so I joined the Navy, and went to a couple of schools, had been doing some medical work before the draft notice, and was actually, over the years, by the time I became a PA, had done general orderly work in a fairly good-sized hospital, had become a surgical scrub tech, was an x-ray tech, and then I went to lab school and was stationed up at Annapolis, and then went to PA school down at Shepherd with the Air Force, and that pretty much brings me up to what I've been since then, and that's been a physician assistant.
So, sir, what drove you to want to become a PA versus going back to medical school?
Well, there were some difficulties that occurred that I really won't share, but okay. Just things that happened along the way and the time frame and so forth, and probably I lost a little bit of desire to do the total number of years, and of course then I was in the Navy, and the opportunity to go to PA school came along, and I decided to do that.
All right, sir. So, was there any specific influences that influenced you to go to PA school?
Well, other than the fact that, you know, I really had set my sights on medical school for a number of years, actually in grade school, actually. And so it sort of fit. I mean, it was a way to do what I saw pretty much what I could do as a general doc. And my, you know, my ambition at that point had been to go back and be what at that time I called a country doc. And so it made some sense to do that.
All right, sir. Now that I can concur with that. That was some of my original thoughts as well, sir. Some specific questions related to the IPAP. Sir, can you tell me some more about your involvement with the IPAP?
Well, let's see. Yes, I can. I was, the main Navy rep that from 1992 to 1995, actually into the spring of 96, that sat at the meetings that occurred to put the program together. And one has to understand that this was from an ITRO, which was an Inter-Service Training Review Organization that came on the scene in, I guess, the late 80s or something, maybe even before that. But anyway, it began to take shape that what DOD wanted to do was look at programs for there were some similarities with the idea that they would save money. And so this was kind of the driving force. They looked around and they saw the PA programs. They said, these are very similar. They come out... they're about the same length. They're in the same field. They would be transferable, basically amongst services in the future, and that's kind of how it began. And the time frame for me, although not the very first, there were, and you'll be able to find this from some of the other reps. There were a couple of meetings, I think in '91, with people like Ernie Edmonds and Bill Meeker, and then. There was the Army program director at that point. I can never quite say his name. It started with a T, Tone, something like that. And they had a meeting or two. But then in 92, things began to become, I would say, I guess a little more heated up. And that point, it was myself and a secondary rep, Bob O'Mara. There was a PhD educational specialist by the name of Karen Natkin, who sort of was with the ITRO group, but actually was stationed at a Navy base. And then there was Vicki Tanner and Hank Lemke for the Air Force. There was Casey Bond and later Don Parsons, along with helpers or assistants at different meetings, to include Polly Gross and Sherry Morey, both now colonels. One retired, the other still active. And so we met probably, I don't know, two, three times, four times a year from 92 to 95, and those meetings were usually 2 or 3 days. I think one of them was even a week long. And we met at either San Diego or Shepherd Air Force Base or here at Fort Sam. And we tried to put together what we thought would be something that could be agreeable to all of us. And that included actually the whole, we had three curricula, all somewhat different, such as various, you know, the Army had a trauma course with all that goes with that. I think the Navy and the Air Force did not at that time. The Navy used sometimes went over to the main hospital at San Diego for some training, but there were other things like that. The Navy had a week-long X-ray course that was taught in the radiology department, and I believe that the Air Force was a little bit more active with using live patients, maybe in their second year up there at the hospital at Shepherd, but I'm not real clear on that. I've kind of forgotten. Vicki probably can help you with that. We eventually put together a curriculum that we could all live with, and there were gives and takes in terms of courses that we taught, and there were gives and takes with the numbers of hours that were taught with most of those courses. The Air Force was very heavy in medicine. The Army at that point wasn't as heavy in the medical areas, and as you can imagine, because the curricula were somewhat different, you had to have a different links. And so we finally were able to put that together. We developed such things as the SEP, the Student Evaluation Plans, that included some of the guidelines for what the students would have to live under, including the tests and the numbers of failures that they would be allowed to have. Which was somewhat different also, because there was not a real wide difference, but there was some difference. I think the Air Force and the Navy were lowest in terms of failures allowed. If I'm not mistaken, maybe it was around 5 per the first year. And the Army had a somewhat longer or more, they were more lenient and they were somewhat more apt to recycle. And the Navy was very resistant to that because we only had the one class. So it was hard. First off, it would have been hard to recycle someone if they failed in the first semester and hold them for the next year. So the Navy had very few recycles. I think the Air Force had very few at that time. The Army did, just because they were having, I think they had two major sessions per year at that time, or three maybe. And then we tried to look at how PAs or students would be selected. And that was something that was kind of beyond our ability to control, because each of the services held that they would select the people that they wanted at their own particular selection boards. And I'm not sure that that's really changed at this point. I think so. What we were more able to do was to look at what the requirements were and try to bring them together, so that they were certainly more uniform, that they had to have a number of hours of chemistries and physics, and you know, eventually they got down to, I think, some basic math and different things like that, or college math, and brought that together. But as far as having the board, a single board, and saying, hey, everybody's going to look at these records and we'll select these people, that was pretty much a taboo at that time. Each service said, no, our people will select who we wish. So that was, I guess, that would have been one of the things that was a little bit of a barrier to overcome, because as you can imagine, when you think about the services, and how they were utilized. The Air Force at that point was using their students as basically in the clinic. That I think that has certainly changed tremendously over the years. But and the Army was using theirs, I believe it's called, I'm about to forget, but I believe it was called M plus one. Their PAs would be out in the battalions, and the doc would be back in the hospital somewhere until they were needed. And the Navy kind of used theirs. They had 12 billets aboard carriers at that point, and the rest of them were in clinics and in the outliers of hospitals. So that kind of was something that had to be looked at as how each service used them. And that was a driving point, too, as part of why certain courses were held pretty steadfast by each service that they wanted in the original curriculum because of that utilization. And let's see, where else did we need to go? We actually had multiple meetings, as I said, over those 3 years, and some of those were, as you can imagine, everybody, each service originally wanted the program very, very much, or at least on surface's sake they did. I would have liked to have had it at San Diego, and Vicki, I know, definitely wanted it at Shepherd. When we looked at the different facilities at that time, Shepherd had the best set of computers and the most instructors, I think, that were dedicated to their program. The Army certainly here had the most space and was in the city that was most economical for students to come to and to bring their families and to be able to put them in schools and to be able to get in and out of here to go on leave and vacations and things like that. So you can imagine there were a tremendous number of difficulties that had to be overcome. And that's why I think it took us probably 3 years to sort of get past that. But eventually we did, and we put together what I think was probably a pretty dadgone good curriculum. And as I say, each of us, Vicki and Casey and myself, had to give a little bit in different courses that we hadn't had, and we thought in our thinking at that point that we didn't need them. And that was because of the utilization that we had.
Well, that's impressive, just such a collaborative effort, and then obviously in a joint environment like that you're working in, I realize that the joint environments themselves can create their own barriers and their own problems in themselves. Did you enjoy the process, sir?
You know, most of the time I did, to be honest with you, because we pretty much worked with the same people, and we traveled around to each of the three cities, or the three programs cities. And by doing that, you know, we always, no matter what, sometimes the discussions got a little bit heated, but no matter what, we all got together in the evening, we went out to eat, we enjoyed ourselves, and I think probably the group that put the thing together may well have been as good as any that could have been assembled. You know, there was always an overseer from ITRO with us, so that if there were certain rules or things that came up that could this be accomplished or was there something else that needed to be done, that individual had the wherewith and the contacts to get back to Big ITRO and get a decision for us.
This overseer in ITRO, was this the Air Force mediator?
Yes, and it always was the Air Force. The Air Force was the mediator, and actually, there's only the one I remember. There was a guy, I think, for a short period of time, and then there was a lady, and I can't remember her name. They were actually, I thought, very good. And you know, not only that, but the Air Force were the costing agent. So when we went to costing, which again was sort of intertwined here with how many students each of the services wanted to put into each class, and then that drove numbers of instructors and then had to be divided up proportionally as to who got what and so there were issues that were even on a sidelight with these meetings. And I think we costed, if I'm not mistaken, we costed three times, and the last time was in the spring of 1995. And we were supposed to start in, I believe, that class would have been September, late August, September. That didn't occur because the facilities, the BOS here at Fort Sam was not ready, and that Fort Sam had been designated as the place. The vote was taken, I believe it might have been even in January, or maybe it was in May of 95, and that was taken at Randolph Air Force Base, and that was amongst Vicky and Casey and myself. And I had pretty much been I'd been taken out of the loop as far as getting the program at San Diego. I had worked very hard, including getting into a building there that the Navy had closed down, and I found rooms that would have sufficed, but the cost of living there would have just been prohibitive. So when we looked at this was a very issue that still Casey wanted it very much for the Army, or the Army did, and Vicky was on a trail to get it at Shepherd. And so we developed a matrix, which I don't even have any idea now what all we put in there, but things like air travel, churches, housing, cost of living, schools, churches. There was a whole number of things, a group of things that we put into that matrix, and then we scored them in different ways. Obviously, Vicky, her vote went toward the Air Force. Excuse me, that's my other phone. And Casey's went to the Army, and I therefore had the swing vote. And I will be honest, I actually would have liked to have sent it to the Air Force, because of some of the things that I saw. But in reality, in looking at the matrix, I couldn't do that. And so I voted, as I went down that matrix, and it came here to Fort Sam. And was probably the right decision, if for no other reason, because eventually, as you know now, all the medical has come here. And so there would have been another move, another breakup, and things just would not have gone well.
All right. So looking back, you're looking back at, obviously, you were in the early phases there, and now you're then you were the third program director. So you got a chance to kind of come back to it. Coming back to it, how did that look at it, from that perspective?
Well, let me back up just a bit. When in 95, I was the first non-Army person to come down here to ramp up for that program. I came from San Diego as the program director. I came down here to be the first clinical director. And so I spent 3 years down here then, and had come in the summer of July with the idea that we were going to start, but that didn't occur until, like I say, May, I think it was May of 96. So as helping to put together the, even at that point down here, as the new instructors came in and people began to assimilate, and we brought in, not till January, I think, or did we bring in any other students, but there were difficulties at that time, just because, as you can imagine, everybody, many instructors had been clinicians, they hadn't been instructors, and so there was a good ramp-up time for some of them. Others that weren't, they had done some work somewhere else. I think the Air Force instructors probably had some of the better overall training, just because of how the Air Force does things and their colleges and so forth that they had in place at that point. So then you have to consider that there was a certain amount of baggage that each one of the services people carried with them, their own idea of how their service handled, and that had to be overcome, and I think it was successfully overcome. There were times that there were disagreements and so forth, which you could expect putting something like that together, but overall, I think it was an excellent process. And then coming back, 8 years later, I guess it was, I could see where there had been improvements. The courses had been somewhat refined, some of them a lot, and the instructors were improving. They were getting better. They were realizing that they needed to send in more qualified instructors, which they were. I think pretty much all the services were starting to do that. And of course, in January, I believe, of 2003, when I came in here, at that time, Ed Maxwell was leaving, and they had been able to bring the program up to all students being officer candidates and beginning a commission. But prior to that, if I'm not mistaken, the Navy and the Army had continued to take their people to. They were not officer candidates. They were more of a considered enlisted. And so, but I can't remember all the policies of that. I know that about that time that the Army allowed, I think they allowed some officers to set in the program to begin with. In other words, they were up to, I don't remember what the rank was. Maybe it was first lieutenant that could set into the class. So we actually, there was a captain, I believe, because I think there was one graduated that I recall there early that was graduated as a major. So things change just as you would expect the progression of a program like that to change.
Sir, do you feel like you guys were able, as a group, you were able to accomplish everything you had set out to do? Or do you have to settle for less?
Well, no, I think the fact that we spent as much time early on putting together the curriculum and the SCP and costing and you know what the guidelines were going to be, the phase two sites, which had to be changed somewhat because there were some differences in how the sites were handled, and bringing the phase two sites in that their students would be. They weren't just going to come to them, and they would be their students. They still were under our control somewhat. There were all kinds of things that we were able that probably other people will think of that I haven't that we had to deal with, and just the boards of when we decided to fail students. How did we handle those? It was all services were involved, and there were certainly differences, and like I said, still differences in how. Because of utilization and because of need, how the services wanted to handle a student that was failing. Do we recycle them? Do we keep them? Do we give them extra training? Do we, all kinds of things like that we were able to. I think we probably now, most of those are pretty much a given of what's going to happen, and there's the early problems are not there anymore.
Sir, is regarding some of the smaller pieces to this, if you will. The Bureau of Prisons was originally with the Air Force at their group of college or their PA training program. And do you know, have any understanding of what happened there as far as them not coming, or did they come at some point in time?
There were two areas I, for lack of a better term, I'll call it baggage. The Air Force brought in the Bureau of Prisons, and the first guy that I was involved with that, I can't remember his name. Vicky will remember that. But then I think Rich Voss was involved. They were kind of their consultants or people involved with the department there and with the Bureau. And as far as I remember, the Air Force had either three or four that were coming to them at Shepherd, and they had a contract or some agreement that they would have to allow that many to come down to the program. And I think they only came for one or two years. And that, again, Vicky probably can tell you more about it, or maybe Kathy even can tell you more about that, because I'm pretty sure it was four, though, on 1 year, and these were people that were foreign medical graduates that were having trouble, and they saw that as a way, I think, to get them a license. Unfortunately, if I recall, three out of four failed out, and then that program went away. The Army had an agreement with the University of Texas down here, who did not have a program at that point, to take in, I think it was 10 students a year for the next 3 years when we started. And then we actually went down to UT, I recall, at least going there once myself, or maybe twice, to help them interview students, to select them to come into the program. And overall, they did about as well as our own people. We lost a couple here or there, but then that, after the three sessions, I think in the second year, UT was ramping up for a small program, and then there were no more civilians came in.
Okay, wow. I was unaware of that. That's awesome. Is there any other additional comments that you can think of, sir, as far as the impressions of the early leadership, that we haven't covered at this point?
Well, one of the impressions I was is that overall that we were, you know, we were the going saying at that point was we were going to put these programs together to save money, and the fact of the matter was after 3 years of hard work and meetings and putting it together and costing, there was actually a net increase in the cost. So there was not any savings from what we had, you know, what we were spending for the three programs. So that would have been one thing, I guess, that was a little bit surprising because I thought, well, we probably save some money too. But as happened, it didn't.
One thought was interesting to me, obviously being a graduate of the IPAP, is the distribution of the instructors, you know, as far as how many Army, how many Navy, how many Air Force, how many Coast Guard. Do you have any insight into how that?
Yeah, that was with the costing. See, it was driven as the number of iterations, and then it was and that drove the total number of instructors by the total number of hours of the curriculum and the iterations. And then the second driving force was how many students and what proportion of the student body was each service. And that led to a breakdown of, you know, I think it was 4 or 5 for the Navy and 8 or 9 or 10 for the Army and 3 or 4 for the Air Force. And then eventually, since the Air Force had one Coast Guard instructor up at the Air Force, and I believe that was one there at that time, then we allowed what we all kind of jokingly called the token Coast Guard instructor, and I think they still have one. And then much later, after I left, I believe they now have a National Guard instructor there, but I'm not sure of that.
Okay. So one other question for you, sir. In regards to the joint environment, you know, that a lot of times in military careers, we look at that as kind of a big achievement to be able to work in a joint environment.
Mm-hmm.
And what's your take on that, obviously working there at least twice in a joint environment like that?
Well, you know, I think that everyone who tries to attain the senior officer leader or ranks realizes that for you know, out in the field and in the line and so forth, you have to do a joint tour. You have to get that on your record. And in our case, we fought. That was one of the things that was a little bit of a disappointment, was that we tried very hard to get them to agree that this was a joint venture. And I don't remember all the politics that went with it, but they wouldn't allow us to do that. So we basically, if you will, were joint. In fact, there was, and to show you how joint we had a four-person office that when I was there the first time, 95 to 98, that Don Parsons, the program director, myself, Kathy Adamson, the Air Force a senior person, and there was a doc that was a Navy doc, was all set together in that office. So, and you know, we talked back and forth and so forth, and we're part of the controlling leadership, if you will. So, and indeed, in my estimation, even today, it was joint, and so I think it was a good experience. It broadens your life a little bit, just like other kinds of life experiences. You know, if you stay in one little hole, that's what you know, is that little hole. And if you get out and get in 3 or 4 holes, first thing you know a heck of a lot more than just 3 holes.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. So, sir, is there any closing comments that you'd like to make?
I guess just a short thing. I'm looking back. I'm very glad that I was involved in the putting together of the program, and I'm really glad that I was able to serve there twice, once as the phase two director, and certainly happy to have been allowed to be the Navy's turn at the program directorship, and I think that for me, that last tour was certainly very challenging to be the director, just because of the jointness and the variety of difficulties that came about. But overall, that was a great experience.
Okay. Well, sir, I appreciate your time, and I appreciate your efforts, and I appreciate what you've done with the program. Obviously, I'm a product of that program, and I was actually there as a student when you were the program director. So I appreciate everything you've done, sir.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for your service.